Well, hello everyone. Kurt Franklin here, live from the Information Week studios. It's wonderful to be with you live, and I will tell you, it's wonderful for me to be coming to you from the Swamp Studio of Information Week, and I'm joined by two great collaborators on Information Week Radio. We've got our Director of Editorial, Susan Nunziata, coming to us from the Bay Area of California. Susan, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt. It's great to be here. I thought we had moved the studio to Seattle for a second there, but I'm relieved to see that we are where we belong.
Yes. And also from the Bay Area, that would be the California Bay Area, not the Seattle Bay Area. We have executive editor Dave Wagner. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt. I was less worried that you moved to Seattle, but that your voice had gotten much, much higher.
Yes, after the travels of the last month or so have had many effects, but that's not one of them. I'm pleased to say I've sort of gotten used to my voice in this register. I think I'll try to keep it there. Well, we're going to be doing a roundtable today, and that's one of the things that we really like to do here on Information Week Live because it gives us a chance to discuss some of the top stories of the week. Now, my big stories all have to do with the Sapphire Now trade show that I attended for most of this week. Sapphire Now is SAP's big global event. Thousands of SAP users come together at the Orange County Convention Center in Orlando, Florida, for 3 days of hearing about the latest developments in the world of SAP and in hearing how other SAP users are making use of these latest developments, and frankly, to get fired up about this great enterprise software that they feel, well, part of a large tribe. The main cheerleader, of course, is Dr. Professor Hasso Plattner, who is one of the founders of SAP, and is really to SAP what Steve Jobs was to Apple and Bill Gates was to Microsoft. He is the very visible and much beloved by the faithful leader of SAP. Now, that's where my news is coming from. Dave, what kind of things have you had your eye on this week?
Quite a lot. One of the things I've been using this week at Information Week to do is to catch up on last week's interop news. So we've been talking a lot about some things I wasn't able to finish last week at interop, particularly around leadership. And then yesterday I started to speculate a little bit about where we were headed with wearables now that the Apple Watch is out.
It's interesting that you mentioned those wearables because the Apple Watch was much in evidence at Sapphire. Of all the software you can imagine having a presence on a watch, SAP would probably fall near the bottom of the list. But they were showing a number of demonstrations of being able to not only see analysis on the Apple Watch, but actually to interact with enterprise resource systems using nothing but the watch interface. I thought that was fascinating, and I'll be honest, I find it interesting that one of the other early announcements about software for the Apple Watch was Salesforce.com, another big enterprise player. Susan, I'm going to ask you, what do you think about the whole idea of enterprise software on a watch? Is that something that you see as inevitable or inevitably something that we'll be laughing about in a couple of years?
Well, I tend to fall into the category of skeptics when it comes to what we will be accessing via smartwatches and other wearables. I see the potential for these in the enterprise to be more useful in data gathering and essentially, an Internet of Things becoming an Internet of human beings that are providing data back to enterprises about various things, whether it's for healthcare or for retail or other types of applications where we want to see how humans are behaving. I have a problem imagining how a smart watch could provide me with the scope of information I would need to execute, say, using a Salesforce CRM, for example. But I would remain interested in seeing how they plan to execute, let's put it that way. And perhaps you will all be laughing at me in a year for being such a cynic.
Well, you know, now, Dave, I know you have been a long time skeptic about this kind of thing. I mean, do you see the watch being a natural and inevitable interface into enterprise software?
Well, I am a skeptic about the watch because I feel like it's 3 inches away from my phone, and I don't understand why I need both. But I'm going to take the opposite side on this. I actually think it behooves SAP and other companies to pay attention to this, not only because just because everybody has one, but because one of the things that kept coming up at the Information Week conference, and I had this conversation with Chris Murphy as well, our editor here at Information Week, there are a lot of CEOs and other senior leaders who are in a position where they have certain data that they want to track every minute. And it's usually a number or a small set of numbers that is important to their business. And sometimes that number is changing regularly and quickly. And several people asked the question at Information Week conference, if there was one number you could use to track your business, what number would that be? And so one thing I can see these watches being is a way to track that one thing, that one most important thing that you think your business needs. Now, not every company has that. The larger the company, the less likely that is as well. But sometimes there's just real-time data that you need to track. We talk about velocity of data a lot in analytics, and the watch seems to be one way to increase the velocity of data.
So, Dave, can you give a for instance there? What did you hear at the conferences that people would like to have at their wrist or have at the ready in that way?
Yeah, it really depends on the business. But I'll tell you one that kept coming up because we were obviously amongst a lot of CIOs. A lot of CIOs were interested in something as simple as their efficiency numbers for their data center, their PUEs. They wanted to track that on a more regular basis because it's the largest expense that they have no control over. Or I should say, not necessarily no control, but it's, you can control salary, you can control cloud and that kind of thing, but the price of electricity and that kind of thing is out of your control. So if you need to keep yourself efficient, you need to be aware of variables like that. So that's one example. UPS CIO Jackie Wood said that if she can trim a mile off the average length of her fleet deliveries, she can save, I think it was $50 million. So she was interested in watching that number as it went up and down because it controlled costs. So that's one or two examples of where I think somebody might want to have that number, if not at their fingertips, at least at their wrist tip?
You know, it's interesting because at Sapphire, one of the other things they were talking about was the Internet of Things. And from the SAP perspective, the Internet of Things isn't really about consumer level things, but industrial things. You know, they announced a partnership with Siemens to where Siemens will be using the HANA platform for their big industrial control cloud that all of their industrial robotics customers use. And the kind of thing that SAP was showing was, you know, let's say you are involved in transportation and there's something where you're notified that there's been a major highway disruption because of a horrible accident. And so you need to send extra trucks via a different route to a port in order to offload a ship. Well, they demonstrated this thing where their software would send a notification to you about this problem onto the watch, because that's where you need to get these urgent kind of up-to-the-minute things. So it buzzes your wrist, and then you have the option, and they showed that, you know, you can say send more trucks, how many trucks, and you choose a number. Very simple things on the watch face in just a matter of moments. So in their scenarios, it tended to be more about responding to some condition that had fallen outside the norm, something that had fallen into critical territory that you needed to respond to more or less instantly, rather than just getting sort of a dashboard update. And I thought that was an interesting distinction.
Well, that kind of sounds like my worst nightmare. I would certainly not want something on my wrist buzzing, and I could see, just as in the days I'm old enough to remember beepers, and in the days when beepers first started, or pagers, they were intended to be for emergency use only, and then became something where everything was an emergency and you were getting paged all the time. And I could see the same kind of thing going horribly wrong on your wrist. I get the premise of that, and I just foresee a future where various things start buzzing all the time on my wrist, my socks. You know, Dave wrote about smart socks, and that's sort of a horrifying thought as well. So I will remain firmly in the Luddite camp on this whole business here. I just find it terrifying.
Well, I think your time as a drug dealer made you think differently about beepers, Susan.
No, we're not supposed to talk about that.
I actually agree with Susan that one really questions in that particular case, what's wrong with a phone call or a text? One figures that there needs that scenario is probably complicated enough that you're going to need to talk to your lieutenants about the best way to handle that situation, right? So I'm not 100% sure that that's necessarily a great use case, but at the same time, I know that the cost of not getting that message through is what scares CEOs even more sometimes than the fear of getting too many messages. So perhaps I'm wrong about that, because that does definitely keep them up at night.
Well, you know, Susan, you were talking about the pager, and I know one of the last bastions of pager use has been healthcare. I mean, as recently as just, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, when I was around a hospital, you still saw the doctors walking around with pagers. And for many of the physicians, that's how they got notified rather than their smartphone going off, there was still a pager on their waist that would buzz and show them either a code or a phone number that indicated what was going on. And that's a kind of clumsy segue into one of the things that I find awfully fascinating. In Hasso Plattner's keynote on Thursday, oh, that would be yesterday, he brought up a couple of physicians who were talking about oncology trials in both Europe and the U.S., where the data was being handled using SAP's HANA platform. I remember going back to the days when we would attend Dell World. Dell has a huge presence in the healthcare field. They're very proud of the contributions that the research, which uses their systems, is making. And they even have a chief medical officer in the corporate hierarchy. My question to both of you is, why do companies seem to need to haul out doctors and medical studies to show how important they are? In the world of enterprise, have we hit some sort of psychological tipping point where it's not enough to say, we help companies earn a lot of money? They have to be working to somehow further the cause of human health to justify what they're doing. Because this seems to be a fairly consistent thing. Every IT company, every big computer and networking company that I know of, at some point wants to haul out a doctor to talk about how important this company's technology is to healthcare. I would be curious on each of you having a take on that.
Well, I think that that's accurate, and I think it's an inspiring way for companies to share what they're working on. We had a speaker at the Information Week conference last week, Andy Karaboutis, who's from Biogen, and another speaker from AstraZeneca, Dave Smoley, and both of them related how their uses of varieties of technologies, from big data analysis to enterprise mobility apps, have had a direct impact on their company's abilities to make people's lives better. I don't think that's necessarily a new thing. I think that cause-related topics have always been important for companies to embrace, and there's just a lot of good brand goodwill that comes from that. I think what we're seeing now, however, is so much attention being paid to technology in healthcare because, frankly, healthcare was a bit of a laggard in adopting new technologies until HIPAA and until electronic medical records were kind of forced upon them. That's why you still have doctors walking around with pagers as little as 3 years ago or probably even 3 months ago in some places. So I think it's more a response, in my opinion, to the way the market is going. And let's be frank, there's big money to be made in healthcare technology right now, and a lot of resources being devoted to using technology to improve healthcare, whether you're talking about at the point of care or whether you're talking about in a biotech company or in a pharmaceutical company or just across the line in the, U.S. insurance and provider arena. There's just a lot happening there, and it's a place where there's just a lot percolating. So I think there's two facets there. There's money to be made, and also it's just such a wonderful human story to be able to tell how technology is changing lives.
Yeah, I think everything Susan said is right, and then I would add a couple more. The first I would add is that people want to know their technology can be counted on in life and death situations, right? And there's no more life and death situation than healthcare. So if you can say, look, doctors and emergency room people, they trust us, and pharmaceutical trusts us, then you know you can trust us when that disaster recovery plan goes into place, because you know, lives depend on our technology. And so the money that is dependent on your technology, that's no big deal, because we actually save lives. I think that goes a long way. And then the other is that there seem to be two areas where analytics has really shown some quick ROI. And one is in manufacturing, and the other is in healthcare. I mean, you can find examples throughout any industry, but manufacturing, supply chain, logistics, obvious ROI has come from there, right? Because it's easy to save money if you have better data. Pharmaceuticals, so expensive. The price of a new drug now to be researched is $2.6 billion. If big data analytics can get that price down, it helps everybody. The cost of healthcare until Obamacare, or whatever you'd like to call it, was going up exponentially every year, and it's now starting to arrest, but it isn't going down. So if big data and analytics can help lower the cost there, everybody's for it. So I think those are the reasons, along with Susan's.
Very good. Well, you know, we have talked about the fact that all of us were at the Interop conference last week. Dave, you mentioned hearing some things from the Interop conference. And it's interesting, because of what we were doing and the size of the conference, the three of us very rarely spent time in the same place. I really haven't had a chance to talk, so I'm curious. I would love to hear from each of you what your big takeaways were from Interop. What did you have any sort of conversation? Did you see anything? What left you most impressed going forward? Susan, I know you were up to your armpits in leadership out at Interop. So what did you hear that you took away from Interop?
Well, quite a bit, actually. In fact, my head has been spinning with all sorts of great ideas as I came away from the conference. So I programmed the leadership track for the Interop conference, and also was able to attend and participate in a fantastic Information Week CIO summit that occurred concurrently, that was programmed by our editor, Chris Murphy, and Brian Galulli, who's a VP of Content and Events. And combined, what I took away from what I heard at those two events were a couple of things. One is the importance of humans in technology, and that humans matter more than technology, which Dave actually captured quite well in a blog post on the site this week as a follow-up. The second thing I came away with was, alongside that, how crucial your culture is, the culture that you as a leader create in your organization makes or breaks the future of your company and the future of your own career and the career of those who are with you. And so I heard again and again the importance of creating an IT culture that encourages people to experiment and innovate, not only in big idea ways, but in small ways through the course of their day, and to encourage failure in a safe way quickly, and create a sense that it will not cost you your job if you have an idea you bring forward that for one reason or another does not succeed, because that is the only way that folks will feel comfortable coming out with new and innovative thinking. And it was interesting in a session during Interop on the leadership track where one of the IT professionals in the audience who works for Coca-Cola raised that challenge. And it's not unique to Coca-Cola or any other enterprise, but the challenge of getting ideas heard in the organization. And so I came away thinking, okay, how can we help folks in the IT community encourage innovation and encourage ideas and learn how to be more open and create a culture that encourages fresh thinking, encourages diversity, and puts humans at the center of the conversation about technology.
Very interesting stuff. You know, that whole notion, the idea, I think Chris Anderson called it the freedom to fail. That idea that you can experiment, you can try something and be bold without having to worry that if it doesn't work the way you hope, that it will be a permanent setback for your career. I think that really is critical. And that seems to be a tough, tough thing at a lot of organizations.
Yeah, I think the problem with failure, the reason why people don't accept the failure is that we're playing so close to the margins these days. We're so worried about if it's a public company, our stock figure. We're so worried about our budget. We don't have slack anywhere. Everybody's playing as tight as possible, particularly after the fiscal crisis of 2008, but just in general. And it's always been that way to a certain degree. But in the last 20 or 30 years, people have really been encouraged by the market, among other things, to play as close to the line as possible. And so failure hurts. And so you not only do you have to give your culture and your people a chance to fail, you actually have to plan a little bit for failure in the way you run your company too. And I don't think enough CEOs are doing that.
Well, what did you come away from Interop with, Dave? I'm curious because you were spending your time covering a number of different things, and I know you had a panel at Interop. So where were you spending your time, and what did you learn?
Well, it's funny because I came away with many of the same feelings about people and technology that Susan did. I think on an episode of Interop Radio, I brought it up as the interoperability of people. So I think that's a big deal. You know, we think of Interop as the interoperability of networks and other technology, but the interoperability of people matters. In my session, it was interesting. My session was on where we were succeeding and where we were failing with analytics. And what I came away with from analytics is also sort of a people thing, which is that I came to the realization that there is a disconnect in analytics and the way we're doing analytics that I'm not sure how to fix, but I'm convinced is the problem, which is that in a traditional analytics or a traditional organization, there are at least three steps to analytics. The first step is that in the enterprise, somebody in technology collects all the data, right, in a Hadoop stack or a database or whatever. And then it goes to somebody who is an analytics expert, somebody who massages the data and presents it to senior leadership. And then senior leadership looks at it and decides what to think about it. Well, what I'm hearing over and over again is that by the time that data gets to senior leadership, it's entirely different from where the data started. Part of that is because people are massaging the data to make sure it fits management needs. Part of it is because everybody looks at the data and gets a different conclusion. Part of it is that management doesn't know how to look at the data. But what we have is a necessary divvying up of skills, but it's creating this game of telephone so that by the time the data gets to the end of the line, it's not the same data that started. And that's a human problem, it's a skills problem, and it's also a technological problem. And it's something I think we need to work on. I think of it as analytics 2.0. I think everybody who's been in analytics knows how to store big data now. And now they're trying to figure out how to use big data. And that's the next hurdle.
You know, it's interesting that you mention all of that because I spent some time with the analytics team at SAP last week. We're going to have some articles at Information Week and some interop radio episodes on analytics and the representation of data, because that's becoming a bigger and bigger issue. You know, we've got all of this information coming out, but how do you use that information to tell the right story within the enterprise? And it's fascinating for me, someone who has built a career on telling stories, to hear these enterprise data scientists talk about the importance of telling the right story. I think that's going to be an interesting set of things to watch over the next couple of years. You know, I didn't get to really spend much time in the conference at Interop. I spent a lot of time around the InteropNet and the SDN labs. And there were a couple of things that really struck me there. One is that it's now possible to build a software-defined network using nothing but free and open source software. That's something that we're going to explore more with Interop Radio over the summer. I talked to the people who are heading up the SDN lab. They're very excited about that possibility that rather than having to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on new enterprise class equipment, if all you want to do is learn about a software-defined network, you can really build yourself a learning platform for just a couple $100s. And I think that's going to really help bring a lot more expertise into the field as network administrators and architects are able to get hands-on and play with the software-defined network technology. And the hands-on was the other piece. You know, we had some very high-level people at Interop in the InteropNet. I mean, we had, for example, one of the people there was the chief systems architect for HP's services group. And yet he was busy racking servers at one point. And there were people all over who were pitching in to do things like terminate Cat 6 cable. And I heard a number of people say that they really enjoyed being able to remind themselves of the very hands-on skills that they used when they were getting started in their careers in networking. And in a very real sense, they wanted to convince themselves that they hadn't lost that ability. You know, they're all working at very high levels, very conceptual, strategic levels now, but they love the idea that they haven't lost the ability to do the hands-on work, that they haven't lost touch with the bare bones physical infrastructure pieces. And it was very interesting to me listening to that. It compares, I think, in some ways to the auto executives who on the weekends like to get into their garage and work on restoring a classic car, because even though they're dealing with, you know, millions of units of strategic material up at the enterprise level, they really like to remind themselves that they still know how to properly, you know, change the spark plugs and put on new wires and set spark gaps and timing on an engine and all that. To me, those were two really interesting things, and they both boil down to the hands-on factor. Is that something that you could relate to with anything you were either hearing or seeing as you walked around the halls of Interop?
That's interesting, Kurt. You know, I can't say that I saw or heard anything along those lines, though I can completely relate to it. I think in my own experience personally, as I moved through the ranks of publishing organizations, to become an editor and a manager, it got me further and further away from the thing that got me here in the first place, which is writing. And so I think everyone kind of feels that way as they start to rise up in an organization. Many times what happens is you get completely removed from the thing you loved in the first place because you become, someone who's looking at spreadsheets or, looking at overall performance. And so you miss the chance to be hands-on. So I can completely relate to that. And I love the idea that what you were doing there and what you were seeing there involves people just putting aside their rank and their hierarchy and rolling up their shirt sleeves and jumping in when they needed to. And I think that really is kind of the spirit that I saw everyone bring to the event, actually, and the spirit I kind of see in IT in general, is that most folks are pretty down to earth and willing to do what they need to do to get stuff done. And it's nice to see that that was actually live and in action in your experience at Interop. So that's great.
Well, I know on the weekends I only write with a quill pen and ink just to get back to my roots. no, but I had a very funny experience. I won't say who, but two very prominent CIOs who were there as part of the Information Week conference. I ran into them at a place serving alcohol in the show floor, and it was clear to me that this was not the first drink that they were having that day, and they were watching the Interop Awards being given out, and they started talking to me because they knew I had shared one of those awards, and they asked me how they were done, and I told them, and then they looked at me and said, we're going to have to start thinking about networking again, aren't we? Networking's really hot, isn't it? And you could see the light bulb went off in their head that it had been something that they had neglected by position, by rank, by other priorities, and that they were realizing that they needed to go back and rethink and relearn what they had once been a part of before.
I love the idea that not only were they relearning that the hands-on, the networking mattered, but once again the essential truth of the phrase in vino veritas is brought forth.
Yeah, they actually reminded me a lot of Statler and Waldorf from the Muppets. Everywhere you went in the meeting, they were fantastic. They were sitting together and they were talking to each other and commenting to each other about everything, both positive and negative, through the whole meeting. And I kept finding myself accidentally sitting near them and hearing them. And it was a fascinating learning experience because they were essentially thinking out loud about everything they saw. And they were doing it seems like, seemingly tipsy for the entire 3 days of the conference that I saw them there. It was fantastic. They were wonderful.
That is outstanding. And speaking of truth, we've hit that point in the show where it's time for Dave, you to talk about the truth of the Geekend. So what's going on with the truthiness of the Geekend?
Right. Well, today we have a little bit of a sort of admission that I have sort of dismissed an important segment of something. A few weeks ago, I published the Geekend basically totally lambasting NASA for their inability to do space research at a reasonable price. And I still stand by everything I said about their sort of big-ticket research items. But I had a fantastic conversation with a nonprofit that works with NASA called CASIS, the Center for Advancement of Science and Space. And they run, as part of the International Space Station, they run the U.S. laboratory. And their job is to talk about, or to commercialize space. So they go and talk to commercial companies about doing research in space. And one of the things they told me, and that I've discovered, is that the price of research in space for a commercial company is consistently dropping to the point that now Fortune 100 companies and startups are now regularly doing experiments on the International Space Station at extremely affordable rates. And I was very shocked to find this out. And the article goes into a lot of detail about the kinds of companies and the kinds of research. But one of my favorite pieces of research that's going on right now is how do we figure out how to get the oil to not sit on the top of the peanut butter? And I never thought that that would be something that we would talk about in space.
Well, you know, peanut butter actually, I think, is one of the elemental substances of the universe. So it does seem appropriate in that sense.
It definitely binds us all together, right?
Especially when there's no milk to be had, yes.
Yeah. But no, I can't name too many of the companies because their experiments are not public yet. But there were some really fascinating commercial consumer companies that when you heard what they were doing, you'd think, why in the world would that company, you know, that it's known for making fizzy beverages, want to invest in space? And I really gained a new appreciation for what space experiments can be about, the cost, and what we can learn from it, and apparently so are consumer companies, because just a year or two ago they were having trouble filling all of the experimental space in the International Space Station, and now they're turning people away. So what I suggest in the story is that if you don't have a space research strategy at your company, you need to get one.
I'm not sure that we have a space research strategy. Perhaps that's something to bring up.
Yes, well, I'm thinking of volunteering. If UBM wants to send me to the International Space Station, I am ready and willing to go.
Don't tempt me, Wagner.
I didn't say banish me to it.
I've talked to the ISS on amateur radio. Does that count?
I think that's awesome, and I do, and I think that that's one of the most important things to remember about the ISS, is that while the ISS is there to do serious research, it's also sitting there in low orbit as the representative for all humans in space. You know, it's hard to think about a rover on Mars representing you, but here are actual living, breathing people living in orbit. If you're in the right place at night, you can actually see the International Space Station pass above you. You have to know where to be at the right time. But I have actually watched the International Space Station go above me in orbit at night in space. And like, it's a real thing. And it's just amazing to watch this space station fly over your head just like an airplane would, except obviously higher up, and think about the fact that there are people there. I think it's really important to think about the space station differently than we think about a lot of the other projects we've been doing in space lately.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the things, I laugh about talking to the space station, but to me the cool thing is that you can do that using what is essentially the amateur radio version of a walkie-talkie. Something that you hold in the palm of your hand. You need a little external antenna to guide the signal up there. But, you know, as you say, it's line of sight. If you know where it's going to be, you point the antenna in the right direction, key up your walkie-talkie, and by golly, you're talking to the space station.
Yep.
Well, it seems like We're coming to the end of today's program, and I want to let both of you know that I very much appreciate you being here. Susan, I'm curious, first of all, what do you have coming up for the next week, and where can we keep up with the wit and wisdom of Susan Nunziata on all of the Tweety Pipes and other social media?
Well, I have been rather witless on social media. In fact, practically invisible, but my Twitter handle is at Susan Nunziata, and my goal is to get more active there again, so you can look for me there. And coming up, a couple of exciting things. I'm heading back to the East Coast, where I hear it is finally above zero, and I'll be attending the MIT CIO Symposium the week of May 18th. So I'm looking forward to that and looking forward to reporting, getting back into the ink business from that event. So you'll be seeing my byline for a change. And next week, we have a lot of exciting slideshows coming up, including one that will be talking about why PCs still matter. So keep an eye out for that on the pages of informationweek.com next week.
Ooh, sounds very, very good. We will look for all of those things. Dave, how about you? What do you have in the pipeline for the coming week? And again, how do people follow you on a moment-by-moment basis?
Well, apparently Susan is going to pack me off to the International Space Station for that crack about her being a drug dealer. but before that happens, I will be I'm working on a story right now about five or so job apps that are bringing dignity back to the job search, which I think is something that an awful lot of people are looking for. Lots of other fun and interesting stuff coming up, and you can find me at Geekend Dave.
Outstanding. Well, as for me, I've got a lot of things to digest after Interop and Sapphire. I've had a couple of pieces on Information Week this week from Sapphire. There will be more coming up in the coming days. And once again, we're beginning the Interop Radio cycle to follow up from Interop. You know, the cool thing about Interop is that it is a community. It's the voice of the IT community, and therefore it doesn't stop. We had the live event. People are getting home and sorting through all of the stuff that they brought home with them, and we'll be kicking off Interop Radio once again. We'll let everybody know about that. If you want URLs and info, please follow me at KG4GWA. Well, for everyone here at Information Week and Information Week Live, I'm your host, Kurt Franklin, saying thanks for being with us, and hey, we'll see you next time.